Oh, yeah. So this afternoon, of course, we'll return to this first phase, day one, of Shamatha Without a Sign. I want to emphasize that we're coming to this practice through an ongoing sequence of subtraction, not addition. Just a brief reminder. Then in the mindfulness of breathing, as we do have a sign, that if we have a vector, we have a directionality to our attention with a target that we're really focusing on, even as we're attending to the sensations of the breath, at the same time, there is, at least implicitly, and we're trying to make this explicitly, an awareness of awareness. It's already there. And as you're applying introspection, monitoring the flow of mindfulness, you're also aware of what's coming up in the mind, right? While the main force of your attention is focused on the sensations of the breath. And then, as if taking off an outer garment, like an overcoat, then when we go to settling the mind, we now withdraw our attention away from the body, having already in mindfulness of breathing withdrawn the attention from surrounding environment and kept it within the skin, so to speak. And now we withdraw even from the somatic field, from all five of the physical senses, purely into the mental domain, and we do attend to that. So once again, there's a sign, an object, a target, and that is both the space of the mind, that's something we're attending to, as well as, of course, the events arising in that space. At the same time, I've emphasized, even when settling the mind in its natural state, let your awareness remain in its own place, illuminating the space of the mind and its contents, but not getting caught up in them, not carried away by them, attending to them without grasping, right? And so now we take off another layer of clothing as we move from settling the mind to shamatha without a sign, and we just let awareness stay home. You know, just not moving, and it's called, again, shamatha without a sign, because it has no target, no sign, no object that it's attending to, but rather it's just resting right there. But it's by nature cognizant. Cognizance is not something you add on to awareness. There is no such thing as awareness without cognizance. And likewise, the luminosity of awareness is not something you have to strive to accomplish. It's by nature luminous, just like you don't need to add heat to fire. If it's not hot, then it's just not fire. If it's not bright, then it's not fire. So in a similar fashion here, this is a process of subtraction where we're now sustaining that flow of awareness that was already there. We already knew we were aware of being aware before we did this practice. And now we're just resting there in simplicity, in nakedness, with no directionality to the attention, but letting it just be cognizant of what remains when it's not attending to any object. And what remains is awareness of being aware. It's very existential. It's very naked, very nuclear. So you recall that pointing out instruction from last Saturday, I think it was, when Padmasambhava is saying, what do you mean you can't do it? What do you mean you can't do it? It keeps on coming back. Observe your mind. Observe your mind. What do you mean you can't do it? And he's really kind of chiding us. You know, I think with a kind of scolding with a smile, that you're making this more complicated than it needs to be. When people come to me and tell me, oh, Alan, I've heard the teaching on awareness, but I don't think I know how to do it. I've been really trying to do it, but I don't know how to do it. Doing, trying is missing the point. Okay? And that is, it is overcoming the addiction, the obsessive compulsive addiction to doing. And what's left over? Well, what's left over may be just going to sleep. Like, nothing's happening. Okay, that's not shamatha without a sign. That's called falling asleep. So that's why we're not doing anything, but then resting in the sheer luminosity, the cognizance, the clarity of awareness, without letting it be veiled by dullness, right? But we're not doing anything. And then are we trying to do something? No, if you're trying, again, you're doing more than is necessary. It's releasing effort, and just staying home. There it is. An analogy would be that in our day-to-day life, just ordinary way of using, driving our minds, that just habitually throughout the course of the day, we're either in some forward gear, often in forward gear, you know, first, second, third, whatever. I want this. I really want this. I really, really, really want this. We pump it up to a higher and higher. Well, I kind of want this. I want this. And so we're going forwards. We're seeing something we want, right? Or don't want this. Oh, I don't want this. And so then we're into reverse. You know, maybe we have two or three gears in reverse. You know, I really absolutely don't want this. But it's basically I want, I don't want, I want, I don't want. And we're always going forward and backward, forward and backward. But you've all noticed when you get into your car that you, before you put it into a forward gear or a reverse gear, it's already turned on. It's in neutral, right? That's how you start out, in neutral. That was already there. Before you got moving, either forward or backward, the engine was already turned on, right? Your engine is already turned on. Before you start meditating, the engine's already turned on. The flow of awareness, and in fact, the awareness of being aware, is already turned on. You don't need to do something to turn it on. It's already turned on, right? And it's even turned on implicitly when you're, let alone when you're dreaming. Of course, you're aware of something. You're aware of the dream state. You don't know it's a dream, but at least you're aware of something. And then you know that, and then when you wake up, you know that you were dreaming, so therefore there must have been some awareness of being aware during the dream. Otherwise, you could never recall, I was dreaming that, right? But even in deep sleep, there may indeed be no explicit cognizance. That is, you don't actively, consciously know anything. There's not much to know, but you don't even know the little bit that is to be known, and that is that you're asleep. You don't even know that. So there may be no explicit or conscious knowledge of anything when you're in deep, stage four, non-REM, non-lucid sleep. Right? But do you have zero consciousness at that time? Do you have zero? Like, is the light totally turned off? And I would say, no, it's not possible. And there's very, very clear evidence of that. If somebody comes and shakes you and said, wake up, wake up, you do. But if you had zero consciousness, it'd be like talking to this pair of eyeglasses and saying, hey, wake up, come on, show some liveliness here, hey. Or stop shouting at it, put a Bunsen burner under it, hey, wake up, pair of glasses, wake up. Well, of course, there's nothing on earth you can do to wake up this pair of glasses because it's got zero. It's got zero. There's nothing you can do to it. When you're deep asleep, you don't have zero. Otherwise, you could never wake up. Right? Even if you are fully anesthetized, well, there's no explicit awareness, but the drug wears off and you come back. Even if you die, well, something triggers it, you come back to the bardo. You know? So we never have zero. We never have zero. Even people in a vegetative state, sometimes something weird happens, you know. After 10 years, then lo and behold, they have no idea why they came out of the vegetative state. They were comatose. Suddenly, they're no longer comatose. And there's more evidence now. I've just been reading recently that even when people are in a vegetative state, there's some, by implication, studying their brains. It looks like there may be actually some cognizance there. There's no behavior, but there may be something really going on inside, which, again, is cognizant. The simple point here is that we're always in the midst of a flow of cognizance. During the waking state, during the dream state, it's explicit, but even while in deep dreamless sleep that is non-lucid, that is, we don't know we're asleep, even there, it's still there. So we're trimming back. We're trimming back all of the clothing in which we, you know, the garments in which we clothe our awareness of this, of visual, auditory, remembering, imagining, figuring out, dreaming, and so forth and so on, all the configurations, that's what they are, all the configurations of consciousness, right? We're getting unconfigured. That's why Padmasambhava in the passage this morning said, settle your mind in its natural state, its unconfigured state, its raw, naked state that is still conditioned consciousness. It's not Rigpa, it's not ultimate, it's within samsara, it's within the flow of time, it's arising and passing moment to moment. But it's stripped back to its bare essential. So that's what this practice is, and the challenge of this practice, but it's not a terrible challenge, it's not that difficult, is when we're in this mode of just being present, as you recall, because we're going to do the same practice now as we did this morning. It starts out by not even seeking explicitly to be conscious of being conscious, but just release into the present moment. And don't focus on anything at all. Just don't pass out. You know? Just be present in the present moment. And then after you've kind of settled into neutral, the engine's humming, and you're not going anywhere. not desiring nor feeling aversion towards anything, just being present. Without focusing on any object, without thinking about anything, without getting caught up in any kind of cogitation or conceptual knowing, can you still sustain a flow of cognizance even when you're not attending to anything? Now, if you can't, then, okay, work on that. In other words, if you immediately become drowsy. Dozy, is that even a word? Dozy-do your partner, I think, but I don't think so. Drowsy. Or you're starting to doze off, or getting dull, or what have you. Then, you know, but actually it's easy. Just the cognizance you have right now, you don't need to add on cognizant of that. You can just be cognizant. And then just get the taste of that for yourself. That without focusing on any object, without conceptualizing anything, the flow of cognizance, of knowing, of ascertaining can still be there. And what do you know? You know that you're sustaining your mindfulness without distraction, without grasping. You know you're in the present moment without slipping to the past that is gone and the future that hasn't yet come. You know that. Sustain that knowing. That's the essence of this practice. Right? So you're sitting there in your car in neutral, and you know the engine's on, and you know you're still. And in that stillness, then he says, and I'll give a little bit of guidance in this session. Then he says, now, note what's left over when you're not attending to this or that. And what's left over is, wow, it's pretty obvious that I'm conscious. And I won't give any heaviness to the personal pronoun, I. Never mind, that's just a placeholder. We'll worry about that later. So let's strip it back. Wow, there's awareness of being aware. And I will suggest as a hypothesis, that is our most indubitable knowledge. That which we can know with greatest certainty. You can be very confident now that you're not dreaming. That you're not actually lying in your bed someplace, sleeping and dreaming. You can be very confident, but not 100% confident. It could be a dream. I mean, you've had some really vivid dreams on occasion, right? You could be delusional. You could be psychotic and having a fit. Actually, you're in some mental institution, you know, back in your home country. And you're just having this psychotic dream right now. You know, I mean, how likely is it really? You're in a tropical paradise listening to some California ex-hippie talking about Buddhism. Isn't that rather implausible? Is this very likely that it's actually happening at all? The odds are really heavily against this. So you're psychotic and in an institution having a delirial fit right now, or you're in Phuket listening to Alan Wallace talk about Buddhism. There's room for doubt. But there's no room for doubt at all that awareness is happening. You wouldn't even know how to doubt it, because as soon as you're doubting it, you're consciously doubting something, which means you already are aware that you're aware. Final point before we jump in. This is the only shamatha practice I know, at least taught within the Indo-Tibetan tradition, in which there's no reference at all to introspection. It doesn't even come up. This is the most elaborate presentation of shamatha without a sign that I have seen. They're probably larger, but I'm not very erudite. But in these multiple stages taught in natural liberation, it's very rich, it's textured, it's multi-layered, has multiple stages to it. And he refers to mindfulness, but no reference to introspection, of monitoring the flow. No reference to balancing out, if you fall into this, if you fall into that, then do this. Now that you've recognized it with introspection. There's no reference to that. I think we must know Padmasambhava knew about these basic practices. It's kindergarten level. Right? But for this practice, he is suggesting, as he does in that first day one, he said, rest there. And even when you're just resting, you remember? He says, now stabilize your attention. And now stabilize, it's nepa, which means stillness. Really bring about a stillness. Quit quivering. Quit fluttering. Just be still right there in the present moment. And so on occasion, really stabilize, really focus, even with no target, and then relax, and then really stabilize. Heighten your interest. It does not mean contract. It does not mean tighten up. It does mean pay attention, loosely. But it is an arousal of attention, arousal of interest, right in the present moment with no target, right? And then he says, relax. And then really focus and relax. He said, that will be enough right there. That simple strategy is enough to overcome laxity and dullness. There's your built-in antidote, right? Later on, he's going to give another one that will overcome excitation and agitation, right? So the antidotes are built right into the practice without trying to multitask, and that is be aware of awareness and also be aware of the flow of awareness of awareness. Now it's really single-pointed. It's just being present in the present moment and then raising the question, what is this consciousness? Really focusing and then releasing, focusing and releasing, this alternating. It's that theme, it runs through a lot of Dzogchen practice, especially shamatha, of the real focus and then the loosening up, and the focus, this undulation. And we find that type of undulation recurs all through nature. Pulsating quasars down to pulsing elementary particles and so forth. And there's kind of a pulse. And the whole universe, in the Buddhist view, and there are many believe this in modern cosmology, many and not all believe, that right now it's expanding, and one day, if there's sufficient dark matter, maybe it will reverse, and it'll go into a big crunch, and then out to the Big Bang and Big Crunch. It's one hypothesis, never been disproven. The Buddhist view would say, well, that's right. That's actually the way it is. That it's not just going into infinite entropy, and then that's the end of the whole universe. But there's this oscillation. That's a Buddhist view of cosmology, that it is kind of a pulsing. And so here's a theme that runs through all of nature in so many ways, you couldn't even list them. And so here in this practice as well, that release and then the arousal, the release and the arousal. It's kind of like working out in a gym. You know, you pump and then you release, pump. So it's, you know, it's a very, very common strategy. What Padmasambhava did not say, nor does he say anywhere in this teaching, is conjoin it with the rhythm of the breath. So that was my interpretation. One way of teaching it. And so why did I introduce something that's not there at all? Because it isn't. The undulation, as you saw, because you can read the text, now the notes are all available. But why the breath? And that's because I've been teaching this for a long time, and quite frequently when I do teach it, then people, if there's nothing to hold on to, if I just throw you into the deep end of the pool and we just do what he says, some people feel a bit disoriented, spaced out. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do. Where do I hold on to? I can't do this. And then people get frustrated, and I would really like to protect you from frustration. And so as a preliminary phase, just like counting the breath, a preliminary phase, if you find it helpful to deliberately maintain this peripheral awareness of in and out breath, and then the natural sequence, of course, is during in-breath. So that's the time to really arouse and focus. During the out-breath, a natural time to release. Insofar as and for as long as that method is helpful to really maintain the ongoing coherence of your flow of awareness, then good. But at least one of you has already found not so helpful, a bit multitasking. And what somebody asked me, I think, today, is that really necessary? Or could I simply not engage my attention with the breath at all? And just do the practice, and that is, do the practice, do that undulation, that release and the arousal, but with no connection to the breath. And the answer is absolutely yes. You don't need to add that connection to the breath. If it's helpful, why not? Sooner or later, you're going to want to abandon that, release that, because after all, that is multitasking. It's going off to a sign, whereas this practice is really intended to be without a sign. But if it's helpful to get you into the practice, get you familiar, give you a little safety blanket or a little comfort blanket for a little while, then why not? And then when you're ready, then just release any deliberate attention given to the breath, and then just do the practice very simply as Padmasambhava teaches. So, you're tapping into something very deep here, tapping in the very nature of awareness itself, and I think we can say with great confidence that if there is any element of our existence that does carry on beyond death. Obviously, not going to be flesh and bones. We know what happens to that, right? There's no mystery there. And in terms of all of the mental events that are arising independent upon the brain, your configured mind. Well, if it's arising independence upon the brain, and the Buddha, Gautama, you recall, when he let his body really get trashed because of austerities and weakness and emaciation and so forth, he found his mind didn't work very well. Remember that, yeah? That he's perfectly aware that the mind, as long as we're embodied, is arising independence upon the body. And if you let your body get really, you know, in bad shape, like he did through his austerities, then the mind doesn't work very well. So this is not some breaking news. Hey, there's a mind-body relationship. Mind rises independence upon the body. Hey, this is old news, really old news, right? So we know that. The mind that arises independence upon the body, well, it's not that mind is not going to arise when the body is no longer functioning as a living body and the brain not a functioning brain. But consciousness, that one for modern science is frankly just a flat-out mystery. I don't know how it could be any more of a mystery. They can't define it. They can't measure it. They don't know what causes it. They don't know what it does. They don't know how it interfaces with the brain. They don't know how the brain interfaces with it. There are really no fundamental questions about the nature of consciousness that the mind sciences have answered at all. And they've had 135 years to do it, now with really good technology. And to my mind, I don't see any evidence of really making any progress. They like to think they are. But then you say, what? They can't even define it, for heaven's sakes. And they can't measure it at all in anything. A human fetus during the first couple of months, is it conscious? They don't know. A person in a vegetative state, comatose, brain dead, don't know. So how could these intelligent people, I mean, there are so many intelligent people in the mind sciences, work for 135 years scientifically studying the mind and come up with squat diddly when it comes about all the fundamental questions about nature of consciousness? And, well, I think there's an answer. You don't get to know about the nature of consciousness by studying things that are not consciousness. The brain is not consciousness. Behavior is not consciousness. And that's what they're really good at studying. But when they have all these materialistic assumptions, these what I call illusions of knowledge, it's actually obstructing them from actually getting to the real issues by observing the mind directly. Because they say, oh, no, that's not scientific. Well, I think it's the only scientific way. If you really want to know the nature of phenomena, you don't get it by studying phenomena that are not mind. You get it by observing phenomena that are mind. And that's what we're doing here. So I think we may be coming to the end of the dark ages that have been imposed upon the mind sciences and human civilization for the last century by these illusions of knowledge, which is just so much metaphysical baggage that is preventing the scientific community from actually observing the mind in a rigorous fashion. And that's where the contemplative traditions of the world, Buddhism very, very much within that context, have a lot to offer here. If there's anything that continues on after death, it's not the body and it's not the mind that arises independence upon the body. We're looking at it. We're looking at it. Raw, naked, bare, unconditioned, unconfigured consciousness. If anything carries on, that's where you should place your bet. It's either that or nothing. So let's find out. As Lama Zubar Rinpoche was asked, remember, is it necessary to believe in reincarnation to practice Buddhism? And he said, no, you need to know it. What good's a belief? I mean, beliefs can be useful, but they're only a preamble to knowledge. So now let's practice. I front-loaded it so much, we don't need much during the session itself. I have to quote him correctly. The question was, is it necessary to believe in reincarnation to achieve enlightenment? Of course, you can practice Buddhism without knowing continuity of consciousness, but to achieve enlightenment, do you have to believe in reincarnation? No, you have to know that. You have to discover it for yourself. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states and calm the discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing for a little while. may continue with the gentle Vas breathing in this practice if you wish. With or without that special breathing, let the breath flow in its natural rhythm, effortless, unconstrained. And with your eyes at least partially open, evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you without focusing on any object. Just be mindfully present in the present. Do nothing more than sustain the flow of mindfulness, which is simply being aware, without distraction and without grasping. Then oscillate between arousing your interest, arousing your awareness, focusing, concentrating, and then releasing deeply, relaxing. Set your own rhythm, either in conjunction with the respiration or independently of that particular rhythm. whatever thoughts come up, you have two options. And one is, as soon as you note them, simply release them instantaneously, sustaining a flow of non-conceptual awareness as uninterruptedly as possible. The other option, as soon as you see that the flow of non-conceptual awareness has been interrupted by some thought, memory, and so on, simply rest your awareness in its own nature and let that thought dissolve of its own accord, release itself right back into the space of the mind. Then occasionally ask, what is this very consciousness that is present right now? Observe closely and relax. Observe and relax. And let's continue practicing now in silence.
원하소.
For those of you who have had some teaching, perhaps some practice of Dzogchen, you may be wondering what's the difference between Dzogchen meditation, Tekchu, breakthrough meditation, the difference between that and the initial phase of this practice, where you're not even really seeking to attend to consciousness, you're just being present. Not slipping into any, as much as you can, not slipping into any kind of subject-object bifurcation of experience, just being present and not doing anything at all. Isn't that already Dzogchen? And the answer is, if you're resting in Rigpa, yes. If you're not, it's a prelude to Shamatha. That's not an interpretation. This is exactly what Padmasambhava is stating. That is, in this text, Natural Liberation, you can buy the book and you can see he has a lengthy discussion of the preliminary practices, impermanence and so forth. It goes directly to Shamatha, coarse method, subtler methods, comes to this one, and the immediate prelude to Shamatha without a sign is that, where you're not even focusing upon awareness itself, consciousness itself, you're just being present, period. But he's assuming you haven't yet realized Rigpa, you've just done the preliminaries, you've not even been introduced to the Dzogchen view yet, right? And so that's a prelude to Shamatha. What maybe the popularizers of Dzogchen, when they give a weekend or a week-long retreat and say, okay, now you're a Dzogchen practitioner, if this is what they're teaching in terms of method, you can call it a Rolls-Royce, but it's still a VW with a Rolls-Royce grill. It's proto-Shamatha. It's just before Shamatha, a very elegant starting just before you actually enter Shamatha. And then what you will find, and you can read it for yourself if you have the notes, Padmasambhava says, do this practice until you have settled your mind in that natural state, until an authentic realization of Shamatha has arisen. He says it. That's not my interpretation. This is not my system. And then he goes directly from that into Vipassana, and then into Dream Yoga, and then Dzogchen itself, bona fide Dzogchen, the actual view of Dzogchen. And when you have, whether pointing out instructions, because he gives pointing out instructions, when you've received the pointing out instructions and you really do get the taste of this unconditioned, utterly transcendent dimension of consciousness, which is none other than Buddha mind, Dharmakaya, Buddha nature, and you have you're resting in that, then methodologically you go back to what we just did. That is, you're not doing anything at all, but you're not resting in your coarse mind, in neutral, you're resting in Rigpa. And Dujum Lingpa says, because again, I want everybody to know this is not me debating against some other teacher in the modern world. I wouldn't listen to myself if I were debating on this point. This is Padmasambhava, and then it's Dujun Lingpa. No, it's not Dujun Lingpa, it's Padmasambhava. Because it's Dujun Lingpa's mind treasures, again, and it's tracing right back to Padmasambhava. And so the Vajra essence said in extremely clear terms, Dzogchen meditation is nothing other than sustaining the Dzogchen view. You're not doing anything at all. It's having internalized, realized, there we go, having realized the Dzogchen view, which means, of course, viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa, having realized that, that's the view, then the meditation is just, okay, keep doing that. Of course, you're not doing anything at all, just sustain that flow of being Rigpa, viewing reality from that perspective. There's nothing more or less to Dzogchen meditation than that in the textuate phase. So you have the view, the meditation, the way of life is living in accordance with that. So I won't elaborate on that right now. But that's the difference. People often ask, what's the difference between Shamatha without a sign and Dzogchen? Well, I've already shown this is the initial phase of Shamatha without a sign, and it would be Dzogchen meditation if you've already realized Rigpa. If you haven't, it's a preliminary to Shamatha, right? And to think that you're already realizing Rigpa, well, enjoy your drive in what you're imagining to be a Rolls-Royce, which in fact is a VW with a really cool grill. So, now we go back to the text. And it occurred to me, one thought arose to me over the weekend, oh, I better hurry up, because we're already 2 weeks through the retreat, and I've only covered a few lines. And then I thought, who said? Who said I have to hurry up? I am in charge here. I'm the decider. And we don't have to hurry up at all. If we wind up spending 7.5 weeks on the 7-point mind training, and we have only half a week for the Bodhisattva Avatara, That'll be 7.5 weeks really well spent. You can always go to the, one can say this is kind of, this is, this practice, the 7-point mind training is derivative of Bodhicharvatara. You know, it's rather the same flavor. Bodhicharvatara, it's lengthier, it's fuller. But we're studying the Bodhicharvatara already in its very essence as relayed by Atisha. So we're going to just take our time here. I'm not in any hurry. I'm loving this. You know, each verse, each aphorism is just so utterly cool that I'm not going to rush through it. Just like years ago, Klaus Heben, our benefactor here, he took me to the second finest restaurant in all of Australia. It was a fusion. It was in Sydney. It was a fusion of Japanese and French cuisine. And it was the whole evening. He rented a whole room in the restaurant for a group of friends. And so we had something like 11 courses. Each one was about as big as your thumb. That is, when they started, I said, oh, I won't take the whole course because I can't eat that much. And then I saw how big the servings was. I'll eat it all. And then I said, never mind, I'll take the whole thing. Because, you know, each tiny, tiny service. But when you're sitting down for a meal like that, can you imagine going through the 11 and say, make it snappy, I'm in a hurry here. And okay, bring on the next one. You know. Okay, this is better than that meal. It's better. So we're not going to rush through it. No gobbling down the aphorisms of the 7-point mind training. Let's savor them. So the next verse. Even the antidote itself is liberated in its own state. I haven't looked at the Tibetan for quite a few years of that particular one, but I think it's Nyembo Nyikyang Rangsar Derl. Nyembo Nyikyang Rangsar Derl. Pretty sure. It kind of rings a bell. I'll check later, but right now, even the antidote itself is liberated, released, freed in itself. In other words, the antidote doesn't need an antidote. The antidote itself is liberated in its own nature, by its own nature. So these are the wisdom teachings, right? This is going to ultimate bodhicitta. This is wisdom, this is insight, and it's being presented as a direct antidote to the root cause of samsara. And the root cause of samsara is avidya, not vidya. Ma rikpa, not rikpa. And so the antidote for not rikpa is rikpa, because ma means not. So it's a double negation. The not of the not is not not. It's rikpa. It's just rikpa. So rikpa ultimately is the antidote for samsara. And not just knowing, I mean, we know a lot of things that have not gotten us out of samsara, but knowing reality from the perspective of rikpa. Knowing reality from the perspective of being awake. Remember that wonderful story from Drona, his name was Drona. And he was, I think he was a wandering ascetic, and he saw the footprints, he saw some very strange footprints, obviously in the ground. I think he actually saw the Dhammachakra, which is one of the marks of the Buddha. He saw these footprints, quite large and very distinctive. And he was so stunned or perplexed by them that he traced them like a hunter tracking a deer. He traced them to who put down these footprints. And he traced it right to the Buddha, because the Buddha had made the footprints, obviously. And he saw him, and he was really quite awestruck by the Buddha's presence. And he was not the first one. A lot of people just coming into the presence of the Buddha was like, took their breath away. Just his sheer presence. And turning to the Buddha, having now traced the source of these tracks, he said, who are you? Almost like, what are you? You know, because he didn't look normal. The Buddha did not look like just an ordinary guy. But he said, what are you? And I can't quote it directly, but I can quote it very closely. I said, are you a god? The Buddha said, no. Are you some kind of celestial being? The Buddha said, no. Are you some kind of an earth spirit, an elemental being? No. Are you a human being? He said, no. Who are you? I'm awake. That was his answer. I'm awake. The most interesting no response was to, are you a human? But of course, he had a human mother. He had a human father. That's not in question. He had a wife who was human. and a child who's human. That kind of brackets them in, doesn't it? But when asked, are you human? He said, no. Reminiscent of Dupan Rinpoche, saying, I probably look human to you from the outside. But from the inside, it's very different. So the Buddha simply said, I'm awake. If you were in the midst of a non-lucid dream, and of course, that means you don't know you're dreaming, and you encountered somebody that was actually totally lucid, in other words, one of these people who projects his or her awareness into your dream, was awake and was coming there to wake you up. So that person you're speaking with is totally lucid, and you're not. And maybe this person displays some miracles or whatever. Why not? If you're lucid, you do pretty much whatever you like in a dream. And you ask this person, are you human? What's your notion of being human? That this is real. That you're really human. You have a real father, real mother. Everything here is real. And you're asking this person, I am human. Are you like me? What would you say if you were lucid? I'm sorry, but I'm not like you. You think you know what it's human? You think you're identifying with something of being human in this dream? I'm not that. And I'm not a god or a celestial being or an elemental being. I'm lucid. And that's what I came here to help you become. That's the Buddha's mission. So you wonder, what's the Buddha's working or job description? Wake people up. So there it is. Even the antidote itself is liberated in its own state. Rigpa doesn't need any liberating. It's by nature Rigpa. Rigpa can't become unawareness. Rigpa can't become unawareness. Rigpa is always Rigpa, which means, as I said in that case where I think I referred to Jude, you know, 2 minutes before you achieve arhatship, your Rigpa is already there. And it's not Marigpa, it's Rigpa. That unborn awareness is already there. And it's already knowing, but it's veiled, veiled, veiled. And that's why that knowing is implicit and not explicit. So Buddhist practice is to make implicit knowing explicit. So even the antidote for samsara, even the antidote for marigpa, for unknowing, unawareness, ignorance, is liberated in its own state. It's by nature free. So now, once again, I go quote the Vajra Essence to unpack this a little bit. From the Vajra Essence, this mind treasure from 1860s, the Lake-born Vajra manifestation of Padmasambhava states the ground. Now you know what the ground is, right? That non-duality of Dharma-dhatu, the absolute space of phenomena, and primordial consciousness, the primordial non-duality of those two. The ground is unmoving throughout the three times. It's not within the three times. It transcends the three times while permeating the three times. The ground is unmoving throughout the three times, and it does not change for the better or the worse. So it is called immutable. Unchanging. Because it is endowed with the seven qualities of the indestructible Vajra, it is called Vajra. So this I'm just offering as a commentary to the natural liberation, the natural freedom of Rigpa, which is indivisible from the ground. It is the ground. Imbued with seven qualities of the Vajra. So what are these seven qualities? These again, as I read through these, it's very easy to listen to this and to think of these seven qualities being attributes of something that you don't have. Something outside, something you're learning from Buddhism as an object of knowledge. But of course, what Sokye Dorje, the Lake-born Vajra, is referring to is you. When you get totally unclothed, you strip off the identification with all that is not you or yours, release all that false, delusional identification, and you strip it right down to your ground, that which you are now and have always been, is describing your core essential ground awareness, not somebody else's, yours. Seven qualities of your awareness on this ground level. The first of these is invulnerable. Pristine awareness, your Rigpa, is invulnerable to all karmas, mental afflictions, and habitual propensities. What a relief. That is, in these coarser levels, the level of substrate consciousness, coarse mind, we're massively configured, burdened, driven, propelled, sometimes overwhelmed by our own karma, our habits, our mental afflictions. We know what it's like. But the assertion here is, sure, that's true for the coarse mind. It's also true for substrate consciousness. It, too, is conditioned by karma, memories, and all of that. But at your core, at the ground, there is a dimension of your being that is invulnerable to all of the karma you've ever accumulated and all the mental afflictions that may come and go. And all the habitual propensities, all our habits, it's never touched by them. It's invulnerable, this dimension. So, what's the job then? Release your identification with everything that's not that. Just that, that's easy. I mean, that was simple. Maybe not that easy, but it's certainly simple. Just release identification with everything that's not that. You don't have to antidote all those things. Just release. Second quality, indestructible. This pristine awareness is indestructible by any object or contributing conditions. That is, you may have a nuclear bomb land on your head. That's a pretty thoroughgoing annihilation, right? It will definitely destroy your body so you can't even see any dust. The substrate consciousness moves on. It has to move now. You know, it can no longer be here. You're now in the bardo looking for some other place to be embodied. So it actually had some impact on your substrate consciousness. You're now on the move. It doesn't even touch Rigpa. One atom bomb, million atom bombs, doesn't matter, doesn't touch it. Invulnerable, indestructible. Third quality, it's real, yangdakpa. It is real, for it abides as the originally pure, intrinsic nature of the great. I've learned recently, it should be in. I'm going to change that right now. Come on. For it abides in the originally pure, intrinsic nature of the great primordial ground of the whole of samsara and nirvana. That's a mouthful. It's real. This is as real as it gets. For this pristine awareness abides in the originally pure, intrinsic nature of the great primordial ground of the whole of samsara and nirvana. Okay, that's as real as it gets. It's incorruptible, fourth quality, for it cannot be contaminated by any good or bad qualities. As you develop the four measurables, bodhicitta, all kinds of virtues, it doesn't get any better. You can be inundated by the most intense mental afflictions or enact the worst of all possible evil actions. It's just incorruptible. It's not touched. It's not contaminated. It doesn't get better. It doesn't get worse. It's immutable, coming back to this point. It's immutable, for it is unfluctuating and unmoving throughout the three times. It transcends the three times. It's said to be in the fourth time. That transcends the past, present, and future. It's immutable, beyond change. It's totally unobstructible, the sixth quality, for it can pierce even the most subtle cognitive obscurations. These are the thinnest veils. They're afflictive obscurations, klesha avarana, and then the subtlest cognitive obscurations, which you start purifying only when you're up on the eighth Arya Bodhisattva Bhumi, if you're following the Sutrayana path. Here, resting in Rigpa, it's totally unobstructible even by subtle cognitive obscurations in the absolute space of ultimate reality, which transcends causality. It transcends time, it transcends change, therefore transcends causality. And then finally, it is invincible, for it cannot be transformed by either samsara or nirvana. It transcends the very dichotomy between the two. And it is the one taste of samsara and nirvana, equally present in the most hellish of all realms of existence to the most sublime of all realms of existence, throughout the whole bandwidth of samsara and nirvana, equally present in all. In other words, resting in Rigpa authentically, there's no preference for nirvana over samsara. In Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche's marvelous commentary, rather short, utterly to the point, and his final testament, especially to his Western disciples, this wonderful book that I've asked the front desk to order, they've done it by now, called Enlightened Courage, Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche, great Dzogchen master, his commentary to this text. He comments there that when you have followed the Bodhisattva path and you're coming to its culmination, like the 10th Arya Bodhisattva level, you're almost a Buddha. When you're right there on the cusp of the final veils of cognitive obscurations vanishing, you're ever so close to perfect enlightenment, perfect awakening. He said, when you're right there, face to face with perfect awakening, he said, from that perspective, you have no preference for nirvana over samsara. So those are the seven qualities, suggesting this natural liberation, that you never try to free. There's nothing you can do to free rikpa from marikpa, awareness from unawareness, because it never is unawareness. It's never, it doesn't need any freeing. It does get obscured from our perspective. And then, just a little bit more. Again from the Vajra essence. Never, even for an instant, have you been separated from the originally pure ground, free of conceptual elaboration. But by failing to recognize it, you have not apprehended your own nature for yourself. As a consequence, you have been deluded by grasping to the true existence of the constant stream of joyful and painful appearances. Now, with great wisdom, you recognize manifest primordial consciousness. And by apprehending the profundity of your own state, you are self-liberated. This is like recognizing the wish-fulfilling gem and honoring it, which then frees you from poverty. So that's really the essence of Dzogchen right there. And you might have some intimation why, in this context of practice, there's simply an overwhelming emphasis. This is the one thing to do. There are many worthwhile things to do, many hedonically worthwhile things to do, many virtues, many ways of being service in the world, many, 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 countless. And they're all good. If it's virtue, it's good. There are many, many types of meditation entailing doing this and doing that, discursive meditations, visualization, stage of generation, stage of completion, the six perfections, Shravakayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, there's tremendous, and that's just in Buddhism, let alone the wonderful practice in Christianity and Taoism and so forth and so on. Many, many wonderful practices. But in Dzogchen it says, you know, the most important thing is to wake up and let everything flow from that. Just have everything be focused on waking up. Become lucid in the waking state. So that if somebody asks you, are you human? You say, no, I'm awake. And let everything flow from that. This is Dzogchen. We have a bit more time, and I'd like to share with you one of my favorite parables from the entire Buddhist tradition. Lo and behold, it comes once again from Padmasambhava. And it's the Buddhist version of the prodigal son. So the prodigal son is a very famous parable in the teachings of Jesus. So if you don't know what it is, Google it. Here's the prodigal son in the Buddhist context. So we see this is a recurrent theme among the great wisdom traditions of the world. Here's the parable. This is quoted in A Naked Awareness. Naked Awareness. I translated this text also. This is the sequel to A Spacious Path to Freedom, both of these by Kama Chakma Rinpoche, who is a great master of both Mahamudra and Dzogchen. So he cited this from Padmasambhava. Here's the parable. I'm just going to read it. In the center of the land of Oregon dwelled the vastly wealthy and powerful king, Akashagarbha, with his queen, Vimala Prabini Manojnya. His son, Prince Kirana, who was immature and foolish, and his wise minister, Surya Nashim. So the stage is set. You ready for the play? On one occasion, the prince went to a great festival and became entranced by the spectacle of an illusionist's apparitions. So in classical India, they would have these sorcerers, not using tricks like David Copperfield or the other magicians, all their technology and so forth, but actually using just three things. One is the power of samadhi. Secondly, is having some kind of a substance that you'd use, kind of a little prop, but it's nothing high-tech. It's something really quite simple, like a stone or a piece of wood. Very simple. And the third is use of mantra. Those three. Okay? And using that three, these would be the conjurer's articles, stuff they use, you know. And using these three, samadhi, mantra, and then some physical substance, then the conjurer would create these illusions. Just these marvelous, like you would just see things appearing, and they seem totally real, right? But if you went there and tried to touch them, you'd say, oh, that's like a holographic image, which is, again, high-tech. This is high-tech contemplative, where science is really good at high-tech technology using material stuff. And so this illusionist came to town. He's a performer. And come one, come all, you know, and then he makes these incredible illusions. But this young teenage prince, who's kind of not the sharpest pencil in the box, he gets totally mesmerized by these illusions, just totally sucked in, drawn in. Like, wow, totally sucked in. So he became entranced by the spectacle of the illusionist apparitions. As a result, he became deluded, forgot his identity and his home. He entirely forgot who he was. He just slipped into it. And then when the illusion kind of dissolved the illusion and went away, the prince is just, he's literally dumbfounded. Like, where am I? Who am I? What? Completely amnesiac. Like, it just kind of like a spell came across him. He didn't know who he was. And somehow he'd been distance from his entourage, so they lost touch with him, he's lost touch with them, so there's nobody around. Anybody know who I am? Nobody has got a clue. And so, he wandered for years as a vagrant, suffering miserably. So, there he is in his nice clothes, but he gets hungry, and he has not a clue where to go. So he finds some vagrants, some homeless people, who are out, you know, just begging. And he said, well, they've got a he doesn't have any skills. And so he joins these vagrants, these homeless people. And he starts going on their rounds, begging. And they let him in, sure, come on, there'll be enough for you. And they're just going from house to house. And after a while, his clothes turn to rags. And so he kind of looks like all of them. And then he assumes the identity. He really thinks he's a beggar. He's a homeless beggar because he can't remember anything else. And for years go by. And he's just wandering around the kingdom with this group of beggars. And now he thinks he really knows who he is. Yeah, he's learned his craft. He's learned how to beg. And he looks like a beggar, he acts like a beggar, he thinks like a beggar. He's identifying with him being a beggar. But he suffers a lot. Not much fun to be a homeless person, begging for your meals from day to day. In the meantime, the kingdom, the palace, they're distraught. They've lost the heir to the throne. They will go out, send out search parties and so forth, not be able to find him because he just disappeared, you know, among the homeless people. And so they're really, really distraught. I mean, it's an awful thing for the kingdom to lose its, you know, heir to the throne. So eventually, when the kingdom was falling into decline, he, this prince, Prince Kirana, came to beg at the door of Suryanashim. So Suryanashim, living probably in a nice mansion, this beggar comes to his door, and Suryanashim comes to the door, and he immediately recognizes the prince for who he is. But the prince doesn't recognize the minister. He's still an amnesiac. He's forgotten who he is. But the Suryanashim, he recognized immediately. So what's he going to do? You imagine how full his heart is, jubilation, so ecstatic. The prince has come home. Thank goodness, you know, the kingdom will continue. The heir is here. Looked like there was no other heir. He was it. So Suryanashim identified him and tried to persuade him that he was a prince. He said, welcome home, prince. But the prince, Kirana, said, whoa, I don't need sarcasm. I'm not a prince. You can see I'm homeless. I just wanted some food. So please I don't need the sarcasm, the irony. Prince, come on. If you want to give me a little bowl of food, you got some leftovers. It's very nice. I appreciate that. What I don't need is no food and sarcasm. So please stop telling me I'm a prince. I mean, that's kind of unkind, don't you think? Ridiculing me, making fun of me, as if I'm a prince. I know I'm not a prince. So what's this wise minister going to do? Prince Kirana, feeling himself to be merely an unworthy beggar, did not believe him and refused to enter his father's palace. He probably just expected to be ridiculed more. Everybody, ha, 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 look at this homeless beggar. Let's call him a prince. Let's, you know, really pull his chain. Which would be very cruel. The minister told him what had happened to him. told them how he went off to the spectacle, and they just lost sight of him, somehow lost track entirely. Minister told him what had happened to him and challenged him to examine his own identity, his parents, and his birthplace. He said, oh, okay, you think you're a beggar, are you? Good. Exactly. When did you become a beggar? Tell me about your parents. Tell me about your childhood when you were growing up. How did you become a beggar? Tell me about that. Tell me about your early childhood, parents, and so forth. And who are you? Who is this beggar that you're so firmly convinced you are? Observe your mind. Who are you really? The prince was stunned at what he didn't find. He couldn't find himself, identify himself as a beggar, just the outer garments. He couldn't remember who his parents are, and that's bizarre. And he couldn't remember his birthplace, that's bizarre. He should be able, if he really had parents who gave birth to him and raised him as a beggar, and he was really born someplace as a beggar, then he should be able to remember that. That should be available. But he couldn't. He was stunned at what he didn't find, and he asked the minister to reveal to him his actual nature and his personal history. I'm coming up with nothing. Then you tell me. Who am I really, and where did I come from? And the prince was then enthroned. In an instant, while not disregarding his identity as a beggar, that is, he recognized conventionally, that's how he'd been living. If you act like a beggar, you dress like a beggar, you're called a beggar, then conventionally, that's about as good as it gets to be a beggar. So he didn't become, again, amnesiac, like he suddenly couldn't remember having, you know, last several years of living as a beggar. He is perfectly aware of that. He didn't discard his identity as a beggar. He stopped living in the manner of a beggar. The misery of his being a vagrant disappeared by itself, and the kingdom and all his subjects, without exception, came under his rule, and they lived in great joy and happiness. That's the parable. So now Padmasambhava explains the parable, if it needs explaining. King Akashagarbha represents not falling to the extremes of samsara or nirvana. That's his father. Vimala Prabhini Manojna, his mother, the queen, symbolically represents dwelling with the displays of the luminosity of your own mind. So there's your mom and dad. Prince Kirana symbolizes neither realizing nor being deluded by the momentarily arising expressions of the creative power of your own mind. And then we're just not knowing. Not knowing. Minister Surya Nashim symbolizes the spiritual mentor, the guru, with realization, who is awake, who teaches out of compassion. So Padmasambhava concludes, just as the prince did not know he was a prince and became a beggar, you fail to recognize the ultimate reality of your own mind as the Dharmakaya, and you wander in the cycle of existence. Just as the minister recognized the prince and brought him to the seat of royalty, the spiritual mentor, your guru, identifies the ultimate nature of your mind as the Dharmakaya, points this out to you. And upon becoming freed from the suffering of samsara, you achieve the excellent qualities of a Buddha. And you live happily ever after. So, that's my favorite parable. Let's just sit quietly for a few minutes. It's almost dinner time. Let's just sit quietly. and without identifying with that which is neither you nor yours. Rest in awareness. Simply being awareness. Naturally luminous and naturally free. Hola, so. So it's in this dimension of the teachings in Buddhadhamma, this domain of the Dzogchen, that I find the greatest convergence with the most profound teachings of other contemplative traditions. And I myself also find some very deep resonance from the most profound aspect of modern science, from my perspective, just an opinion, and that is quantum cosmology that I referred to last week. Seems to be there's a very deep convergence there. And so one was focusing here on this simplicity, on this parable, which finds a very strong resonance with the parable of the prodigal son as Jesus taught it. Then one may really feel, without contriving anything or trying to be agreeable, harmonious, just a very deep resonance with the other contemplative traditions of the world, other modes of inquiry, having a sense that we are all moving in the same direction. And then just with that in the immediate background, when Augustine says the love of God is the passionate yearning to know God, and how does he describe God? The changeless light. And the love of God is just, that is the highest priority. He said the love of God has to do with the prioritization. This is straight Christianity, mainstream St. Augustine Christianity. But he said the love of God has everything to do with priorities. It's simply a matter of priorities. That your desire above all desires is the love of God, the yearning to know God, the changeless light. And all the rest of your priorities are then secondary to that. From the most meaningful, or at least second most meaningful, all the way down to, and I give one of my most trivial desires, so don't put any weight into it, but I have used this in the past, and I've got inundated with dark chocolate as a result. I prefer dark chocolate over milk chocolate. It's one of my most trivial desires. It's way down at the bottom, you know? And I'm just giving that example. Okay, what's the bottom? Dark chocolate over milk chocolate. I like them both. Dark chocolate I like better. That's a desire. Now everything, I'd say pretty much that's about as trivial, superficial as it gets. And then, in the Buddha Dharma, highest desire, bodhicitta. Christian tradition, no God. What is bodhicitta? An aspiration to know who you are, to know Dharmakaya, to know Samantabhadra, the all good, the personification, the embodiment of Rigpa, pristine awareness, primordial Buddha. To know primordial Buddha, the ground of all being. So when one goes to that depth, one may find a real resonance, a sense of affinity, even for people who are coming out of very different conceptual frameworks, starting assumptions and so forth and so on, may feel, we have a lot more Dharma brothers and sisters than we thought. They're not just confined to Tibetan Buddhist or this or that. Maybe the family is much larger. So that's it. Tonight, finally, we'll surprise them and show up more or less on time. Enjoy your evening. See you tomorrow morning at 9:00.